Hello and welcome to SciLax, the podcast where we talk about scientific developments and technological changes in Luxembourg, as usual, proudly powered by Research Luxembourg. And in today's first episode of the year 2024, we have a very special guest as usual, and this time from Leiser and University of Luxembourg. Here with me is Professor Marc Zürcher, who heads the cross-departmental research program on health and health systems at Leiser and is an affiliated professor with the University of Luxembourg. His research revolves around a wide range of health economic aspects, including the socioeconomic determinants and consequences of health and disability, as well as the evaluation of population and system-level policies. Marc, thank you very much for coming today.
Thanks for having me.
Very often when I have my guests, I understand they are someone, like in your case, you're a health economist, and I say, what? So my question is, what is health economics actually?
Health economics is often maybe misunderstood or wrongly perceived by many people. So it's good to clarify that. To me, in short, health economics is quantitative social science applied to health, but we take an economic perspective, meaning that we are always mindful of the fact that if we do one thing, there are other things that we have to forego. So resources are limited. So we have to prioritize, and we have to make that process of priority setting transparent and explicit and accountable. So the famous concept of the opportunity costs comes in there. If we invest in hospitals, that's maybe a good thing. But then there will be, with limited resources, there will be other things we cannot do or can do less of. For instance, invest in, say, prevention, promoting healthy behavior. So if we decide to invest in hospitals, we better make sure that the return we get from that in terms of whatever we want to achieve, health gains, hopefully, is higher than what we get from a similar investment in alternative uses of that money. We also care a lot about teasing out causal relationships. So we're not just interested in mere associations between, say, health and economic outcomes. Can go in both directions, but we want to really understand whether it is health that causally determines, say, labor outcomes, or is it the other way around, or both. We are perhaps a little bit obsessed by that, finding out that, and that's of course difficult. Health economists do really a broad range of things. I do a broad range of things. Now, there's what many people may be associated with health economics, which is cost effectiveness analysis. Now, when we look at different interventions, different drugs, different health policies, what are the costs versus the effects in terms of health gains of these policies, and what is the most cost-effective intervention that we can do. So that's a lot of what we do. Also, another classical field is about thinking about how to improve efficiency in the healthcare sector. But then there's also a lot of areas of work that people may not associate with health economics, which is looking at the impact of unemployment on health or the impact of poverty on health, and the other way around, no? Because health also affects your chances of being productive in the labor market or even being employed at the individual level, but also potentially at the macroeconomic level. No? So health of a population can be an important determinant of economic development, of economic performance of a country as a whole, and vice versa. No? Economic crisis can have detrimental health effects as well. Then other work we do, we look at the health effects and economic effects of heat stress attributable to climate change. We look at the impact of economic sanctions on health and health systems. We look at health financing in poor countries. How do you improve health financing and the health system improve in poor countries to achieve better health outcomes and better health equity outcomes? So economists, some may be surprised to learn, do also care about equity, equitable distribution of health. But of course, equity and overall health may be in a trade-off relationship, so you can't necessarily maximize both at the same time. So again, you need to weigh what do you prioritize and how do you balance the two. So this is what economists, health economists think about a lot. We evaluate policies mainly policies that are hard to evaluate using trials, you know, because in medicine, we do a lot of so-called randomized controlled trials where you have a clearly defined treatment group and a control group that doesn't get, say, the drug. In many policy areas we work on, it's hard to randomize the population. Say, if you think of a national policy, tobacco tax or sugar sweetened beverage tax, you won't have a clear treatment group because it's the whole population which is exposed to that treatment. So how do you do it then? How do you evaluate the causal impact? So this is what health economists have been thinking about a lot and are thinking about. We work on health inequalities again, how to measure them, what are they determined by. So really it's a broad range of issues. We work on disability. Well, we have a project here on personal assistance for people with disabilities. We may touch on it later. So it's really almost infinite area of work.
Exactly. And it makes me think that it's really impossible for it to function separate from related disciplines. It's very interdisciplinary, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Health economics in itself is a combination of economics and health. So we need to have some understanding of health. And of course, we're not always trained to do that. So hence the need to collaborate with people that have a primary expertise in health, in medicine, and public health, but also in neighboring disciplines, you know, statistics, epidemiology, health services research, but also sometimes when it becomes a bit more qualitative, we need to understand sociology of health. Political science comes in particular, if we're talking about some of the high-level policies outside of healthcare that likely affect our health and health inequalities. We need to understand the political system. So really, it's a highly interdisciplinary area of work, ideally, or it should be.
And once you have it figured out, you have to get into a dialogue that, for me, at least from my lay perspective, seems to one of the most difficult dialogues, dialogue with policymakers. How is that going?
Yeah, indeed. You know, there's more and more, of course, the demand and the pressure to not only publish your work, but also engage with policymakers. And that's something, of course, yeah, Liza in particular has signed up to, and that's a mission that we try to follow. So in Luxembourg, we collaborate with ministries in various ways. Directly and indirectly, they fund some of our work. So we have specific projects. I mentioned disability as one. And there are other ways of collaborating where they come on board as advisors or stakeholders. So we involve them in our projects as part of the stakeholder engagement process. Now, early on, ideally, so that they can help shape, not influence, but not bias, but shape and inform the relevance of the work and the implications. And of course, the more there is this shared collaboration, the more likely it is that the results get taken up. Hopefully, that's the idea, at least. And then, of course, we work on Luxembourg, but a lot of our work is outside Luxembourg. So my work is on Europe as a whole, but also on developing countries, where we also try to engage policymakers, national ones, but also international ones. And also work a lot with World Health Organization, World Bank, and institutions like that.
As you mentioned, it's time probably to move on to one of the projects that you are leading. So the project about universal health coverage, right? So before you tell me a bit more about the project, what actually is UHC?
UHC is an important, one of the most important topics perhaps in health. The idea is, and that's been promoted by the World Health Organization, among others, is to provide healthcare to the people that need it without causing financial losses and problems. Financial protection is a key concept here. And of course, it should be of reasonable quality. Now, the care that is provided, people shouldn't fall into poverty. So that's the basic concept. The idea or the target has made its way also onto the global agenda via the Sustainable Development Goals that most countries of the world have committed themselves to. One of the goals includes achieving UHC.
I'm queuing it for the second time, but before we actually discuss it, I also know that you prepared a pub quiz question related to the project and to the countries that you're looking at. So if you can please ask the question, and listeners, remember the answer only at the end of the podcast.
So the project is about four middle-income countries, large middle-income countries, so Brazil, India, Indonesia, and South Africa. We've picked those countries because they are an interesting bunch of countries, for one thing, because they share certain features. One feature is that they are highly unequal countries in terms of income inequality. At the same time, they are middle-income countries, so not the poorest of the poor in terms of GDP per capita, but they do account for a surprisingly large share of the population that lives below the poverty line, the absolute poverty line. According to the World Bank, this is $1.90 per day, so really not much. How large is that number? What is the percentage of people in these countries that live under the poverty line as a share of the total poor population in the world?
Great question. Remember, answer only at the end of the podcast. And now coming back to the project. So what is the scope of your work in it?
Yeah. So the work is about achieving or helping the countries get closer towards achieving the goal of UHC in challenging times. It also has in the title the word leaving no one behind. So we care a lot about ensuring that everybody achieves it, and in particular the marginal groups. It includes four countries, as I mentioned, Brazil, India, Indonesia, and South Africa. So huge countries that, as I said, share the feature of being highly unequal, but also the feature of being federal states. And all of them are at different stages of their path towards UHC and facing big challenges. The challenges are partly global. Now, we had COVID only a short while ago. We have always new challenges. There are many natural disasters in these countries, partly climate change induced. So how in that situation, when resources are limited, as they are also in middle-income countries, how do you go about achieving UHC also for the marginalized group in these countries? I'm talking about immigrants, illegal immigrants, and people that are not in the workforce, not employed. They're often not insured. So how do you do that? And we've put together a program of work that covers different themes. So that's about raising resources. How do we raise more money? How do we allocate the money better, resource allocation, equity, so how to improve equity, and last not least, governance and the role of intersectoral collaboration, because achieving UHC cannot only be achieved in the healthcare sector alone, it also requires and benefits from the input from other sectors. And this is accompanied by four methodological areas, such as policy, impact evaluation, decision analysis, so a number of more technical things that feed into and hopefully help apply state-of-the-art methods to answer the relevant policy questions that are out there.
And how much is it actually also trying to convince the decision makers of the importance of UHC?
I think the policy makers need not be convinced of the usefulness of it. I think, as I said earlier, most countries, if not all countries, have signed up to the objective. But of course, it's a somewhat vaguely defined objective, and there can be different ways in which countries implement UHC. Now, you can have a government finance system, you can have a social insurance system, you can have mixed systems. So really, there are different ways of doing this, and it's about finding the way that fits the country and the national context and local context the best. Hence, we have a close engagement of policymakers in each of the countries via national policy fora. The project has only recently started, so it's early days, but we haven't yet got many results. But it's a 5-year project, and it's in its first year together with my previous University of York, and others. So it's early days.
I got the hint. Don't ask me for more, because the outcomes will come in 5 years.
Yes, of course, there's some work that's ongoing and is related to that. So we, for instance, have started looking at the use of new revenue sources, taxation of either unhealthy goods or fossil fuels, no, as one big topic now, which I think is in the current discussion very much. So what is the scope for improving the fiscal space? So essentially the revenues, no, the income that countries have, for this to then be used for investment in health. And fossil fuel taxation is one way that could address multiple goals, obviously, the reduction of fossil fuel intake and using the returns of that for health. So this is one way. We also looked at, are close to finalizing a review of the evidence on the impact of development assistance for health on health outcomes, and we're evaluating different policies, a family healthcare program in Brazil. So really many, many different things are on their way, but final results aren't fully there yet.
Of course, we will discuss it further. Hopefully you'll come to be our guest again or some of your colleagues to discuss it. But when you were talking about this project, you also mentioned the different types of health financing, and I wanted to also discuss that with you. So I know that you looked at those different types and their influence on health outcomes, right? So first of all, can you tell us a little bit of what kind of health financing can we talk about? And what did you find out when it comes to health outcomes?
Yeah. So we compared the big different systems, and we classified countries according to where they are located in each of the systems. So which is, first of all, government finance system, so tax, essentially general tax funded system, versus social health insurance, which is usually associated with your employment, and out-of-pocket system, because there's still many countries in the world where the biggest source of funding is out-of-pocket, is private money. And we had this was a big cross-country study where we used data over a long period of time for almost all countries of the world, where we looked at the impact of the different systems on health outcomes. By health outcomes, I mean infant mortality, under 5 mortality, and adult mortality and life expectancy, in fact. And we compared that, and we found that, to simplify it a bit, that on the whole, government-funded healthcare has the most beneficial effects on health outcomes. Second is social health insurance, and last, not surprisingly, out-of-pocket funding.
Yeah. And you are sure that this is not related to the economies of the countries that you were studying?
Fairly sure. Now, we do obviously control for a number of other features that distinguishes countries, their development levels, so GDP per capita, their demography, and others that could confound the relationship. Indeed, even after doing that, we still find the result that I mentioned. So we feel fairly confident. But yeah, there are always methodological limitations. So I think we have advanced the evidence on that a bit. But of course, more research is always needed.
From my lay perspective, I would also say that it's the government-funded healthcare system that would rule. But still, you have to check it. You have to go through the data. This is what science is about. You need to confirm our feelings.
Yes, I agree. That was also our expectation. But then again, there is a strong drive in many countries towards social health insurance for one reason or another. And it's important to point out that there are limitations to that, or there are potential downsides to that. It may be easier to organize or more politically feasible, but there are downsides. Now, it's usually associated only with employed people, then leaving out others, and that has implications for health equity if the government is concerned about equity, which hopefully it is. So yeah, there are, and the implementation costs of social health insurance tend to be higher. There is a drive there, really, in many countries, and part of the message was really to just raise some caution.
And for the social health insurance, what happens with the unemployed people? Is there a coverage that the government tries to provide?
Yeah. So it varies. No, but that's when there is often some element of general tax that goes to people that are not covered, or they fall out, they drop out. No, that is possible as well. Sometimes there is something built into the contributions to social health insurance that also covers those not in it, but it's mostly tax then that complements that, if possible.
We talked about costs, so let's drop another bomb I have to drop here. So we are talking about the rising healthcare cost, of course. I would say that there are many people who worry about it, policymakers, me personally, I do as well. What about you? Are you worried about the rising healthcare costs?
Maybe a bit less than others. First of all, well, if we talk about countries in Europe, we live in aging societies. We live longer, and that's a good thing. But with it comes the feature that when we get older as individuals or as societies, we require more care and more funding. So in many ways, we benefit from living longer, obviously, but of course, we have to spend more on that. So it's a natural byproduct of a process, which I think we all agree is a desirable one. It's also a byproduct of technological advances in the field of medicine, which, again, we tend to benefit from in many ways, but which is often costly. Hence, we have a gain, but we also have a cost. And that's, again, all comes back to what health economists do. We compare the cost, the additional cost of a certain investment to the benefit we reap from it in terms of health gains. And then we make a hopefully informed decision as to whether it's worthwhile to invest in that or not. We shouldn't just invest in a certain technology because it gives us a health benefit, because there might be other things we can do with the same money that provide bigger gains in terms of health. So we need not jump on all the latest fashions and gadgets in technology. So we need to wait. And that's, I think, what hopefully health economists can provide. Yeah, some rationale, some transparent decision criteria, not the only one, but one that informs that decision, provides one element to inform that decision. Of course, there are other aspects as well to be taken into account, but really comparing benefits, health benefits to the costs and the alternatives that we would forego is quite an important one, I would say. And if we didn't do that, I think that would not be wise and not morally sound even, I would say.
Yeah, but it also means that you need to understand the technologies in order to advise people. So again, we're coming back to this ongoing dialogue with clinicians that probably explain this all to you.
Yeah, well, the very basis of any cost-effectiveness assessment is the effectiveness assessment. We need to have proof that the technologies or interventions more generally have an effect. And what effect do they have on the population? And ideally, we want to know not only what effect do they have on, say, the richest or the best off, but also those less well off at the margin of society. You know, if we care about health equity, and I think increasingly countries and policymakers do, so it's important to factor that into our investment decisions as well, not only the overall health gain, but also how do we achieve health equity for all.
You probably have to repeat this message over and over again, because we all know, I don't want to sound cynical, but we all know that many decisions are made, you know, in a, let's say, situational basis rather than actually analyzing the whole health situation.
Absolutely, yeah. There are many ad hoc or politically palatable decisions that are made entirely without any evidence base on effectiveness, let alone cost effectiveness. So we can only keep repeating that and pointing out the damage that does in terms of health gains foregone, lives lost. Because if we did other things, maybe more traditional, simpler things, we might save lives. And it's important to have that concept of opportunity cost and the benefits of the alternative solution present and be mindful of that and compare it explicitly. And then, okay, there might still be reasons why, for one reason or another, you decide not to take the intervention that gives you the most health gains, but at least then it's transparent. The policymaker needs to justify that. Why does he do that, or she? No? So I think that's important.
Yes, holding accountable, yeah, for sure. In the beginning, I mentioned that you have a lot of different research interests. So we're jumping again a little bit and we're going to look at the health behaviors. So there's quite a lot of work of yours that looks at that. And my first question is, you know, what are health behaviors, first of all, and how much do they influence health outcomes?
Yes, indeed. A fair amount of the work is on that. Health behaviors. So by health behaviors, I mean behaviors that affect our health. I focus on diet, tobacco consumption, alcohol consumption, and physical activity. There are others as well. Sleep is one, indeed.
Coffee, probably, that I'm just sipping right now.
So we focus on those, and they account for a huge burden of disease, indeed avoidable disease, no? Because if only we were able to change our behavior, then we would prevent a lot of that. Talking again about European high-income country societies, we're mainly affected by non-communicable diseases in terms of deaths and morbidity. So the vast share, around 90% of mortality, if not more, is attributable to that. That includes cardiovascular disease, cancer, which in turn are driven to a large extent by behaviors, not only, of course, but at least 50%, if not more, of that burden is attributable to health, poor health behaviors of the sort I mentioned.
The moment we talk about health behaviors, we, of course, talk about, well, we have a free will. We can decide. Why do we need to actually have policy for that? Why do we need to convince people to change their health behaviors? They can just go on if they wish so?
Yeah, of course they can. I think that's a very basic economic principle that we try not to interfere with individual choice. Now we really take that as an important principle, unless there are some exceptions and some what we call market failures, no, where the unrestrained behaviors of individuals leads to outcomes, societal outcomes that are not what we would want, ideally. I give an example, external costs. Now you have the classic environmental external costs from fossil fuels again. Now, so when we're paying the price of petrol, but we're not necessarily paying the damage it all does. You have very similar things in the health behaviors. Tobacco is the classic example. Now, surely cigarettes cost something and the individual pays for that, but does he or she pay for all the healthcare costs that is incurred by the care that is needed then when cancer comes up or other diseases? That's often then society at large, which carries some of that burden. That shouldn't be the case. So we need to align individual incentives and societal incentives, and taxation and pricing is an important fiscal solution there. Hence, the discussion about increasing tobacco tax, alcohol tax, sugar-sweetened beverage tax, which has become popular in some countries, but by no means in all countries. And it always comes back to that discussion about the nanny state. Yeah, okay, sure. And we shouldn't nanny people into behaviors. I'm with you. But unless, there is a limit. People do impose costs on others, that we don't want that. We have people that are not informed enough, nor certainly children and young people. They are not kind of individuals that we assume in economic theory, where we really compare our lifelong benefits and costs of different courses of action. Now, it's very short-sighted, and maybe even many adults, probably many adults, also aren't always capable to really see the long-term implications of their choices today. Now, we see that in other areas. Pension policy, where there's clear evidence there. Now, if there wasn't government intervention, people wouldn't save enough, wouldn't put enough money into savings for retirement. So again, we have a combination of something we need to do today to be well off in the future in the way we would like to be well off. And similar things happen, or the similar context in the health behaviors. Now we have to make a choice today, eat healthy or quit smoking, to be, not necessarily better off tomorrow, but in the long run. We seem to have, as humans, we seem to have difficulties with that choice, with that trade-off. Hence, in order to essentially promote good decisions, now that are in the best long-term self-interest of the people, there is a case for government interventions in some cases, purely based on efficiency grounds. This has nothing to do with nanny state, excessive nanny states, as it is often presented by some. Now, if we get into this ideological debate between free will, nanny state, and so it gets quite polemic. So economics, again, offers fairly clear criteria. Therefore, the cases in which government can actually enhance efficiency, well-being for society as a whole by interventions.
So I understand economic interventions when it comes to, you know, higher tax, as you said. But what about actually promoting healthy behaviors? How does that work?
Yeah, well, the reverse is financial intervention is subsidies. You could subsidize, reward healthy behavior in the physical activity domain. You have the example of vouchers for gym membership and the like. These may exist in other areas as well. Now, health insurance sometimes rewards if you enroll in courses or in physical activity courses, gym membership and the like. So there are both sides of the coin that government can use. The question is, how effective is it? That's where more research is needed. We do certainly see that incentives work, but they don't always work in the way the economists maybe sometimes naively think they do. So there are unintended consequences. Now you have the discussion about intrinsic versus extrinsic motivation, and there's the risk that if you pay somebody to exercise, he or she loses the intrinsic will, and then it doesn't become a very sustainable behavior. So we need to think about that. It's not all about money, for sure. And hence, I mean, yeah, of course, economists have recognized that. Hence all this big area of work on nudging people into healthier choices, which do not rely on financial incentives, but which more generally now make the cost of engaging in healthy behavior lower via making the healthy option the easy option. That can be in cafeterias or in restaurants where you expose the healthy options more prominently. So little things like that, now where you make the elevator less accessible than the stairs, rather than hiding the stairs in, say, hotels or buildings in university. I know the first thing I saw here in the university was that the university has an elevator, or what do you call the stairs there, the electrical stairs.
Escalator.
Yeah. So I was really surprised to see that this was the most prominent way in which students, young, hopefully active people, can move from one level to the other. So maybe there's even work to be done here on site.
Yes, probably yes. As we are slowly wrapping up, and before we solve the pub quiz question, I just wanted to jump ship once again and focus on a last subject that you also look at, and just ask you, what can a health economist do about disability? What can be your contribution?
This is related to work I mentioned we're doing with the ministry here, MIFA, and it's about informing a necessary and reform, and a reform that the country has committed itself to, towards personal assistance for people with disabilities. Now, we're still here. We have a well-funded system for people with disabilities, obviously. Now, this is a wealthy country, after all. But we have a still somewhat traditional system, now, in that people live in institutions. There's a lot of group-based support, and the UN Convention for the Rights of People with Disabilities has shown the way. Now, the objective, and all countries, including Luxembourg, have signed up to that objective of more individualized support and enabling now society, and in particular society as wealthy and well-resourced as Luxembourg, I think has a responsibility to provide the means also for people with disabilities to lead a self-determined, autonomous as possible a life. So that's the background. I didn't answer your question yet. Economists, and we're working again with other people, other disciplines here, but economists can contribute in different ways. Again, resources also in this area, also in these countries, are limited. So we need to really choose what is the best way to improve the well-being of the people that we want to target. So this is not only about health, it's also about health, but it's about well-being as a broader concept. So we need to understand the costs versus benefits there, and there are different ways of introducing personalized assistance, personal budgeting systems. So we need to weigh that and have an eye on resource implications of the different systems, as well as implications on well-being, on what people think about that. And that's why, again, economists can help. We, as I said earlier, we evaluate policies that are hard to evaluate with trials. We can't easily randomize here, we tend not to, but we still want to come to some judgment, informed judgment about, does a certain policy, say, of personal budgeting work better than another? So again, policy evaluation is important there. So I think there are many, many ways in which health economists, but not only health economists, can add to that. And it's clearly an under-researched topic in economics, and it would benefit from having more economics. Economics can also show the contribution that people with disabilities could make to society, but aren't yet making, maybe because they are held back by the current system. I think there are many, many roles that hopefully we can fill as health economists. Yeah.
So I hope to continue that discussion as well once the project finishes and then we see where we are with that. It's a very important project. I do follow it for some time right now, so I hope to see the developments and changes there. And we talked a little bit about contribution of different parts of society. And then in the beginning, it was the people living under the poverty line as such in our pub quiz questions. So I wanted to go back to that. So once again, if I can ask you to ask the question first and then give us the answer. That was all about the universal health coverage in the countries we discussed.
Indeed. Now we focused on the countries that are part of this UHC project, which is Brazil, India, Indonesia, and South Africa. And the question was, what share of the population living below the poverty line worldwide lives in these four countries? So the poverty line is set by the World Bank at $1.90 per day. The data we looked at is pre-COVID, but largely it will be similar today still. And the answer, if I may say, is 45% of the population living below the absolute poverty line lives in these four countries alone. Although these are middle-income countries, so not the poorest of the poor, they actually account for a huge share of the population in real deep poverty there. So hence, another motivation there to do some useful work there. Hopefully.
Of course. And definitely also, once again, context is key here, right? Because we tend to focus on one very important factor. And actually, we're not looking at exactly what you said, the percentage of people living below a poverty line, right? Because we could argue that, Brazil or India, it's as you said, middle income country, right? It's developing so fast. But then we are actually forgetting about behind the scenes, what is happening there, especially from our comfortable seat here in Europe. So I think this is the moment to say big thank you to Mark for sharing all these interesting parts of his work. And now I think I can really say I understand what a health economist does. Thank you, Mark, for coming.
Thank you.
Okay, and this is it for today. Don't forget to subscribe, to follow us, to check what we are writing on all the social media. Please suggest guests or questions or just send us comment, whatever you want to contribute to. And this was Silex, and my name is Hanna Siemaszko.